The world's attention is limited. Today's burning emergency becomes tomorrow's forgotten crisis. When the media spotlight moves on, vital issues in development and humanitarian response risk being forgotten. I'm Adrian Lovett, CEO of Development Initiatives. In this series, I'm asking people with deep expertise to take us beyond the headlines and explore the missing issues, missing voices, and missing data. Join us at Development Initiatives as we ask, what are we missing? In this episode, we're looking at the crisis in Sudan, the clashes which erupted in April 2023 between the Sudanese armed forces and the paramilitary rapid support forces have had dramatic impacts on the civilian population and exacerbated many of Sudan's existing challenges. More than 3.5 million people have been displaced. Violence against women and girls is widespread, food security deteriorating, and Sudan remains vulnerable to climate change and environmental deterioration. According to the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, Sudan accounts now for almost 40% of total humanitarian needs in East and Southern Africa in 2024, and 30 million people in Sudan require humanitarian assistance. Just in the last few days, the INFORM Severity Index has ranked Sudan as the most severe humanitarian crisis in the world. So I'm joined today by Hala Al-Karib. Hala is a Sudanese activist and researcher who's been confronting violence against women and girls and working on human rights, security, and other issues in Sudan and the wider region for many years. She's regional director of the Strategic Initiative for Women in the Horn of Africa, SIHA. And also with us is Jan Egeland, former UN Emergency Relief Coordinator, where he helped to reform the global humanitarian response system and organize the international response to the Asian tsunami and crises from Darfur to Lebanon. And for more than a decade, of course, he's been Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council. Hala and Jan, thank you so much both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hala, I'd like to start with you. You were born and raised, of course, in Sudan. You live, I think, outside the country now, but you were in Khartoum on April the 15th, 2023. Can you tell us what happened that day and how it affected you and your work and your family?
It was, you know, extremely drastic day. I guess it's very difficult for us as human beings to, you know, to assume that there will be a day when you would lose everything. First of all, we had visitors from Uganda. We have auditors who were got a stock at Acropole Hotel, and we have two consultants who were stuck at Khartoum Airport because people were checking in, actually, and then we have visitors from Darfur who were at the hotel in Africa Road called Asaha, and they were stuck there, and those three locations were the first location that the RSF soldiers had went into. And it's exactly typically what the RSF would do when they strike. Immediately, you know, the looting and the terror will start. So people in Khartoum Airport, eventually they were asked just to move out of the airport, you know, and some of my colleagues were able to find the two consultants at the airport road and brought them to their own place. You know, but it was really difficult to get into the colleagues at, you know, one colleague at Acropole Hotel who were, they were quite exposed to the RSF at that point in time, and the colleagues from Darfur in Africa Road. So it was such a difficult week, I would say, because, you know, sequence of events, it continued for a week until we were able to evacuate all of us, I would say.
An extraordinary week, as you say, and very, very difficult times since then. Jan, your team at NRC, I mean, you know Sudan and you know the region extremely well yourself, and your team at NRC has cited Sudan as one of the world's biggest and most forgotten emergencies, right? What are we missing about Sudan today? What are the humanitarian needs that you're seeing? And why do you think there's so little focus on it?
Well, indeed, Sudan was among the 10 top neglected displacement crises before the war erupted 10 months ago. There were millions of internally displaced, there were very many refugees, and there was deprivation beyond belief in Sudan and the world. was neglected, what was happening, as they were neglected so many other African conflicts and crises. Then there was a brief attention in April, May, June, I would say, and then the world went back to focus on Sudan because of the fierceness of this horrific, senseless conflict between two generals and their forces. And then the world went back to business as usual, which was to focus on war in Europe only. And of late, we have, of course, been very much preoccupied with the horrors in and of Gaza. But Sudan is it's a huge country. It has a large population. It's in the heart of Africa. It has so many millions that suffer, and it has so important and negative consequences when it's going bad in Sudan for the whole region. So there should have been much more attention, and it's beyond me really that it's not that such a tremendous emergency is not having more headlines around the world.
Yeah, Hala, the regional politics that Jan pointed to there a little bit are complex, aren't they? Last week, and I should be clear for the purposes of people listening, we're recording this on the 23rd of January, 2024. Last week, the army-led government suspended its membership of the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, IGAD, the regional body, after the head of the RSF was invited to an IGAD summit in Uganda. Is that a setback? Does that matter? How do you see the role played by the regional and the continental bodies in Africa on this crisis?
I think a very valid question to the bilateral organizations in Africa in relation to Sudan. And you know, that question has been there for a while. Crisis in Sudan didn't start in a vacuum. This is an accumulation of ongoing crisis, you know, of atrocities, of violations that has been committed against civilians for over 20 years, you know, and it's a crisis of impunity, and it's a crisis of enabling initially Bashir's government, despite the indictment of the ICC, you know, the position of the bilateral institutions and organizations, you know, were really very desperate to exempt Bashir and obstruct the whole questions of the international justice system, which is, in my view, it could have turned, I would say, the root of the sequence of events. But that never happened. Even when Sudanese has protested and you know, the uprising in Sudan in 2019, you know, overthrown Bashir, the transitional government, the priorities of handing over Bashir, you know, to the international court has not been there at all. There have been some discussion, but the transitional government kind of avoided that option and turned a blind eye to the ongoing atrocities that has been happening in Darfur, which is, it actually worsened after the falling of Bashir and the new structure that was created based on an agreement between Bashir's security committee and Sudan's political parties. So there is the history of impunity and history of involving of perpetrators that has made it easier for and created a sense of irresponsibility among Sudan militarized elite, and lack of fear of consequences has led to this disaster that we are in. There is 40 million people living in Sudan. By the time Khartoum was hit, Khartoum is the capital city that has at least 5 million IDPs. It has a large number of displaced population. And all that happened under, you know, the eyes and ears of the international community. I don't know how did that happen? How did they allow that to happen? And how there was no information about that when at about 8 o'clock we were dropping the colleague at Acropole Hotel, and we saw that all the shops around Acropole in central Khartoum are actually full of ammunition and full of arms, and the RSF soldiers were opening those shops, and you know, you can see that they were packed with arms. So it was a ticking bomb that's waiting to happen. However, you know, the precautions and the response was not equal to the size, you know, of the anticipated crisis.
That historical context that you shared there is so important. And with that, Jan, the UN, of course, very often in a crisis like this, we look to the UN to play a very important role, and very often it does. But in this case, the UN's role has been contested in the last couple of months, hasn't it? The UN has had to withdraw its political mission from the country. What are the implications of that for the humanitarian effort, and indeed, if you can, for the wider prospects for peace?
The implications is that really that we as humanitarian organizations, and especially the Sudanese civil society organizations, are pretty much alone there now in the crossfire and the chaos and the deprivation of Sudan. There is the international community, which is a euphemism for the United Nations and organizations and diplomats and cooperation among nations. It's not really there, I feel, at the moment. The UN mission is being withdrawn. We hope that the new special envoy, personal envoy of this UN Secretary General, Ambassador Ramtane Lamamra, who is a experienced Algerian diplomat, could help broker something. But the talks that has been there in Riyadh, in Cairo, and in many other places has not led to much. On the contrary, we see that there is a lot of fuel for conflict. I think that's one of the things that you might focus on more as a research facility and others as well. How easily we see there is fuel for warlords and armed actors. They do not lack arms. They do not lack resources. Whereas the peace forces are severely underfunded and under-resourced, including humanitarian work. I really hope to see more international diplomacy to get the ceasefire which is needed, and then the talks between the armed actors, so that Sudan is not falling apart completely, as is the big fear.
Hala, when you spoke to the UN Security Council in October, I think last year, you highlighted the devastating impact of the conflict on women. I think you said women's rights must be central to addressing any conflict. Sadly, my country, Sudan, starkly illustrates the consequences of failing to do so. Can you unpack that? What did you mean when you said that?
Well, I think that the failure, the collapse and this current war in Sudan, it's in my view, it's also a demonstration of, you know, of a political failure that Sudanese elites has largely should be held responsible of. The lack of commitments to diversity when it comes to, you know, engagements of women in the diversity, engagements of young people, engagement of Sudanese of different backgrounds, you know, and actors who are stakeholders of the Sudanese states. You know, there is constant suppressions, you know, towards participations in political processes and in decision makings, you know, and in mediating that in a way that would make everyone feel that they have a say. And I do remember, that the transitional governments, and the political parties, they have been extremely resentful, first of all, to the issue of women's meaningful participation. And when I say meaningful participation, it means like a diverse group of women, a diverse group of young people, and a diverse group that represents Sudan, war-affected regions, and so on, by establishing what we called at the time the local legislative councils, which would have given, Sudanese an opportunity to express themselves and to feel a sense of ownership of their regions and things like that. And then the plan was the local legislative council would establish the national one, and then the country would have moved very swiftly towards election. So they have been a constant resistance into a political process that is inclusive, of women and of Sudan diverse population, and still is the case. This is constantly one of the biggest questions in Sudan, part of the political crisis, the question of legitimacy.
Yeah, and how do you see that in this crisis? How do you reflect on the position of women?
No, I mean, well, the problem is that the population is not really involved. The civilian population, not women, not youth, not the elders, not men, for that matter. It's an elite military and political group that is calling all of the shots, and they are supported by external actors that provide them arms and resources. We in the Norwegian Refugee Council helped facilitate a big gathering in November in Cairo, the Sudanese Humanitarian Conference. And this was sponsored by the government of Norway and the United Kingdom and others. But it was Fikra and a number of Sudanese institutions, civil society institutions, academic institutions that helped us assemble hundreds of civil society representatives there in Cairo. And many of them came from Sudan. It was remarkable to see how people came from Darfur, Kordofan, White Nile, the East, the West, the North, the South. And they had very rich discussions on the future of a democratic, inclusive Sudan, and we have to support them, really. It has to be the Sudanese civil society that have to be the basis for a better future for Sudan. But of course, it's not easy, and often you believe that you have a representative group around the table that there will be peace will emerge. I mean, those who have the guns call the shots. So we have to be able to get the armed actors to stop the conflict. And we have to get the international community, those who have influence on the armed actors, to call a ceasefire, and then you can have an inclusive process. I should also hasten to say that all of my colleagues from NRC who work inside Sudan, we work in the Kordofans, in the White Nile, in the East, but also increasingly now in Darfur, where it is horrible. And Hala referred to the situation in Darfur. We're working cross-border and we're working inside. It's very hard to do cross-line work anywhere in Sudan now. We are thoroughly impressed by how the local civil society organizations open the door for people in need, help each other, stand together, and try to make local reconciliation deals. So I think there is the hope for Sudan that the people have not given up on their countries, even though some of their leaders have.
That local level innovation has been happening, hasn't it? Not only in those peace building efforts, but in the humanitarian effort as well. These emergency response rooms, these ERRs, right, working with more conventional local NGOs who in turn are working with international actors. But those local efforts often led by young people, right? Volunteers who are coming together to, you know, practice mutual aid, if you like, in their own community settings. Is that something that NRC has engaged with? And is it something that you'd like to see more of? Or are there complexities that we're missing on how that works?
No, we do more and more of that. And we probably did too little in our past, because there is there is sort of an impulse, if you're a humanitarian agency, to rush in and help lives and build operation. And we're good at that, on the logistics and on the resourcing and the funding and and all of it. And then we overlook the enormous potential, short-term, medium-term, and especially long-term of civil society, including your youth. I'm glad you mentioned your youth, Adrian, because that's increasingly now our priority. Give hope, employment, education, vocational training to youth so that they believe in building their own society and get a chance to do that. And more and more of our work is so-called localization. We work with and through local groups, and we can then bring resources, since we speak the language of donors, and again have the trust and confidence of the donors. We will then work with local society more and more.
I think so far, you know, the response to the crisis in Sudan, it has been fundamentally led by women organizations, by youth organizations, emergency rooms, and other grassroots groups across the country. And, you know, the NRC is really trying their best and playing a significant role in the most difficult and inaccessible places. Having said that, they are one among the very, very few who are in existence on the ground. And that's in itself, it's very, very painful, because one of the challenges that we are currently encountering, for example, we are dealing with mass atrocities. Like, it's quite overwhelming for smaller institutions like ours, for example, to receive, you know, 6, 7, sometimes 8 reports of sexual violence every day. You know, and women who are asking to have access to, you know, to their kits and medical support, you know, while they are stuck in the middle of an RSF-controlled area, you know, and just having to be extremely creative and finding way within the 72 hours to transfer them into an area where they can receive medical support. Having said that, even those, and I'm speaking strictly based on our experience in Khartoum, and right now what's happening in Jazeera, partially White Nile to some extent, and Kurdufan as well. You know, it's quite overwhelming. And the challenge is, those who persist and insist on providing these services, they are at greater risks themselves. So we're not only faced with the largest humanitarian crisis in Africa, in my view, we are faced with the largest protection crisis, because with the expansion of the scale of the conflict, Sudan is very quickly moving towards a famine, because RSF moving in towards Jazeera, you know, and Jazeera was, you know, still, and I stayed in Jazeera for a while, for a few months after leaving Khartoum. They were very productive in terms of food. A lot of the food was going to Khartoum. There is a lot of the food was going to Western Sudan. You know, And so right now, this food production process and channeling to different parts of the countries, which is for emergency rooms, who are establishing community kitchens in central, it's becoming, in central Khartoum and in other parts of the country, it's becoming very problematic to access food. And then, we have a humanitarian aid operations that's largely obstructed, and humanitarian aid organizations that's openly looted. So there is a fundamental and serious protection issue, and the international community does not want to acknowledge that because they don't want to take responsibility when it comes to the protections, to the cessation of hostilities, because ceasefire does not mean cessation of hostilities. During, the first month of the war, there have been a number of ceasefire, but the level of hostilities, the high prevalence of sexual violence that happened during those periods were massive.
This has just been a terrific conversation, and I could ask both of you a lot more, but I know that I have to let you go pretty soon. Jan, in this series of discussions on forgotten emergencies that we're doing at Development Initiatives in this podcast, we probably could have asked you along to almost every episode. It's easy to say that we're living in a more unstable world. It's almost a cliche to say it, isn't it, at the moment, with multiple crises demanding our attention. Do you think that's true? Is this a more difficult time than you've known in your many years working in this area? And if it is, why is that, do you think?
Oh, yeah, it's a big question, Adrian. I've been now in humanitarian work for 40 years, more than 40 years, since I started as a volunteer in Colombia when I was 19. You know, objectively, it is worse because there are many more people to feed. There are more mega crises. There is many more displaced. You go back 12 years to 2011, and there were just over 40 million refugees and internally displaced in the world. And now there is at least 110 million. So it's nearly a tripling in just over a decade. And the number of people displaced by violence is really an indicator of how bad it is. It's an X-ray of how diplomacy, peace building, conflict prevention, and protection of civilians is not really working, and how international relations, including national, local, regional, international conflicts and tensions, have re-emerged at the worst. There is, of course, also hope. We have to end on some hope here. There are more good organizations doing effective and good work. I mean, HALA here represent very important initiatives with and for women. There are many more local, national, and regional organizations that work for good. We're all much more effective and efficient than, say, when I was in the Red Cross movement or the UN humanitarian Undersecretary General. We were for a while pretty well resourced there. From the pandemic onwards, 2020, 21, 22 were periods where record funding, and we were scaling up. Now, what makes me nervous is that many organizations are scaling back. They are cutting staff because their budgets have gone down, and there is still only about 10 serious donor nations on Earth for organized, coordinated international humanitarian work that increasingly focus on and with and for for local organizations? How come we're not being able to get this as a global project of solidarity? It's still too few and largely Western donors behind this humanitarian system. So I hope to see the more good forces coming together to change things in the right direction in the regions themselves, really, because there are many growing economies beyond Europe and North America.
And Hala, Jan sharing there a plea for help, but a note of hope as well. Do you have, when you think about Sudan and perhaps 5 years from now, 10 years from now, do you have some hope?
Oh, absolutely. I have plenty of hope for Sudan. You know, and, you know, yesterday I had a call with a group of young men who wanted us to join all the emergency rooms in Sudan. They are establishing a council and they are bringing together grassroots groups and organizations to join them. And it sounded like such a brilliant and hopeful idea, you know, an initiative, and they have done, you know, a very detailed and tedious homework. So those groups are not really just dreaming, but they are existing on the ground. They are present inside the conflict zones, and they are present in areas that is congested with, you know, with IDPs that has not been supported, and they are doing the work. And I think it's just quite smart considering the scarcity, you know, that Sudanese civil society currently struggling with, is to try to bring together all the resources in one place. So we are trying as much as possible, and, you know, and tapping into the wealth of experience, you know, within the indigenous knowledge and information. Having said that, international solidarity and the support for Sudan is fundamental. It is critical. You know, Sudanese absolutely needs protections. 100% need protections. It's so unfair that Sudanese are roaming from one place to the other on foot, exposed to this violence. There is no IDP camps. There is no safe zones to protect civilians from the atrocities of the war. And nobody is holding the belligerents accountable for the violation they are committing.
Hala Al-Karib, Jan Egeland, thank you so much for all you're doing, and thank you for this great conversation.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Adrian. Bye-bye. Thank you, Hala.
What a remarkable conversation. Thanks for listening to What Are We Missing from Development Initiatives, where we go beyond the headlines to explore the missing issues, missing voices, and missing data. We have more episodes planned for the coming months, so don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and follow us on X and LinkedIn, where we post about a variety of topics around data, development, and humanitarian response. If you think there are important issues that we're missing in this show, we want to hear from you. You can send us a message on social media or email us at info@devinit.org. That's info@devinit.org. Thanks for listening.